Welcome to Non-Zero World, the weekend edition of the Non-Zero podcast. I'm your host, Connor Eccles, the managing editor of Non-Zero. We're going to make some changes this week to the format. Now, we're still going to have a great interview at the end, and this week that'll be with the prominent conservative writer and National Review senior writer, Michael Brendan Doherty, and we are going to talk a bit about Pope Francis and his legacy in international affairs.
He's said things like, Ukraine should have the courage of the white flag.
But before that, and this will be a new weekly feature, I'm going to talk about the most important headlines of the week, or at least some of them from our perspective, and then dive into some of the more important stories with a bit more detail. And now this week, that will include a very underrated story coming out from the National Institutes of Health related to free speech and the Trump administration's crackdown on speech and Gaza. And then I will also talk about the Ukraine war and some updates on the way that negotiations have been going this week. Spoiler alert, it's not been great. But first, let's go to the headlines. The U.S. Space Force, which until recently has focused entirely on intelligence gathering and defensive efforts, released a space warfighting playbook that lays out plans to achieve space superiority in the coming years by developing offensive capabilities, including capabilities that could attack enemy satellites. In 2019, when the Space Force was first created, one prominent critic warned that, quote, unconstrained space weapons development will lead to a competition that makes space more dangerous, costly, and unpredictable to use. A number of struggling actors have sold their likeness to AI marketing companies to make a quick buck, and some are already regretting the decision. One actor reported seeing his clone being used in propaganda videos to support a coup leader in Burkina Faso.
We are Americans from Africa, and we are Pan-Africanist.
Homeland or death, we shall overcome.
While another was shocked to see their digital clone saying that it had come from the future and warning of disasters to come. Nearly all of the world's nations, with the notable exception of the United States, agreed to a new pandemic treaty that should, in the future, help to coordinate a better global response to pandemics and similar health crises. The accord, which is slated for formal adoption next month, creates a program to share data about pathogens and earmarks roughly 20% of emergency vaccines and medicines for the World Health Organization. The WHO will then be in charge of distributing those to countries in need. The low cost of Chinese-made goods is increasingly due not to cheap labor, but to the rapidly growing use of robots and automation in Chinese factories, according to a report in the New York Times. Meanwhile, comments by Tesla owner and Trump ally Elon Musk suggest that Trump's tariffs on China may be hobbling parts of America's own robotics industry. Musk said that China's decision to stop exporting certain heavy magnets, a decision made in retaliation for tariffs, will slow Tesla's development of humanoid robots. Research compiled by The Guardian suggests that most people underestimate how much their fellow Earthlings care about fighting climate change. One international study found that most participants believed they were more likely than their peers to make personal sacrifices for climate change. Now, these beliefs may simply reflect undue cynicism, or they may reflect the well-documented holier-than-thou cognitive bias, which leads people to overrate their virtuousness compared to others. Now, our last headline here, voting is underway to incorporate a new town called Stargate along the southern coast of Texas, where Elon Musk's SpaceX builds and launches rockets. The vote, which is almost certain to pass, would create a municipality slightly bigger than New York Central Park, populated almost entirely by SpaceX employees and executives. Tesla's security manager is running for mayor. Other potentially influential citizens include Musk, who already owns a ranch-style house with a big fenced-in yard in what may become Stargate. Now on to our main stories for this week. Our first one is going to be the situation with regard to Ukraine talks. This week brought a number of significant developments in American-led efforts to push those talks along, but unfortunately, most of those developments seem to be pointing in the wrong direction. So last week, Secretary of State Marco Rubio warned that if there was not some progress in the talks over the course of the next week or two, that the United States would consider abandoning their efforts entirely. President Trump reiterated that warning over the weekend, and the ensuing week did fairly little to suggest that either Russia or Ukraine was feeling ready to budge on its positions. So to give a bit of a recap, Russia declared a unilateral truce for Easter, but of course Ukraine accused Russia of violating that truce, and Russia accused Ukraine of doing the same. And either way, both resumed attacks as soon as it ended. And Russia has done a particularly large set of attacks on Ukrainian cities this week that even earned a rare rebuke from President Trump, who tweeted or truth socialed at President Vladimir Putin of Russia to, quote, stop in all caps. Then on Wednesday, the White House presented Ukraine and the European Union with a set of proposals that it wanted to use as a framework for peace talks. That meeting was undermined in many ways even before it began, because many of the aspects of the talks had leaked over the course of the previous week, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio made the decision to not attend the talks. He claimed that this was not due to any particular issue and that it was simply a change of schedule, but there's certainly an amount of speculation that he did that as a political move. In any case, during those talks, they communicated the U.S. Conditions, which would include a few things that would definitely not appeal to the Ukrainian side. Among them are guarantees that Ukraine would not be part of NATO, but would maintain sort of a significant military industry and would be allowed to have its own military, but not with direct security guarantees. The U.S. intends over time to lift sanctions on Russia, probably more in the long term, and also would want to freeze the conflict along the current battle lines, which would leave Russia in control of much of Ukrainian territory. But perhaps the most politically challenging aspect of the Trump administration's set of conditions or set of proposals is that they say the U.S. would be willing to recognize Russian sovereignty in Crimea as part of a deal. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky lashed out against these proposals throughout the week, saying that Ukraine would never recognize Crimea as Russian territory. But Trump later insisted that he was not asking Ukraine to do so and would only have the U.S. take that step. Now, the near-term sticking point, at least if you take the negotiators on both sides at their word, is whether the talks can move forward without a pause in hostilities. So the Russian side wants to go ahead and move forward with some form of discussions before we are able to see a full ceasefire. And the United States appears to back that position. But Zelensky has made clear that he will not begin talks until the guns have stopped. So all of this is, of course, trending in the wrong direction. But this is a story that we'll be keeping a close eye on, so be sure to check back about it in future weeks. Now on to our second story, and this one is particularly frightening because I think that it has very much gone under the radar this week, but it's a very notable step in the Trump administration's crackdown on free speech. So the National Institutes of Health, which is, of course, the world's largest funder of biomedical research, announced this week that anyone who wants to receive an NIH grant is barred from participating in a boycott of Israeli organizations or the Israeli state. Previously, the administration had focused its efforts to crack down on speech related to the war in Gaza by deporting foreign students who had allegedly participated in protests against the war. Through that, the administration has already removed roughly 1,500 students as of this week, and that number continues to grow. In most cases, it appears that the State Department does have the legal right to revoke those visas, but of course not, or it is much less clear in the case of green card holders as the case of Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia graduate who has sort of become one of the most famous images of this and who has been a passionate advocate for his release, as that made clear. After that, the Trump administration also went after universities and made certain efforts to withdraw funding in order to change curriculums and to have an impact on how they taught courses. That's all held up in the courts right now, by and large, and so it remains unclear what the final effect will be. But this NIH rule represents a more direct attempt to restrict the rights of individual American citizens to express their political beliefs with regard to the actions of a foreign country. And those rights and the right to boycott are ones that the Supreme Court has repeatedly deemed to be constitutionally protected. The rule will be almost certainly controversial because the anger continues to grow in the United States over Israel's conduct in Gaza. Even well before the war, back in 2020, a Brookings poll found that among Democrats who were aware of the movement to boycott, divest, or sanction Israel, known as BDS, among those Democrats that knew about it, about 48% said that they were in favor of it, which means that even at the time and well before this current war, this was a reasonably popular position. And there is a great deal of evidence in public opinion polling and simply in public discourse that opinions have continued to trend in that direction. It's notable that a number of states, and in fact, a majority of U.S. states, have passed similar laws that ban, in different ways, but ban basically any person who is contracting with the state from advocating for a boycott of Israel or participating in a boycott of Israel. Some of those have been struck down by courts on First Amendment grounds, but some continue to stand. So it remains unclear what will happen with this case. You can read more about this in the lead article of this week's Earthling newsletter. If you head over to nonzero.org, we have a great write-up about this that will give you all the details. Now for our last deep dive, I wanted to talk about a very interesting report from the think tank Ember. So ever since the early 1900s, states have done everything they could to secure access to oil, sometimes even going to war to guarantee that access. But of course, most states have contented themselves, especially in the wake of World War II, to simply acquire oil through trade, oil and other fossil fuels. But today, with a growing set of trade wars and also hot wars that are taking place near crucial choke points in global shipping, it may be time for states to find a more secure way to guarantee their energy security in the future, according to the think tank Ember. Ember notes that there are roughly 52 states that are particularly vulnerable to the whims of global oil markets and any geopolitical changes that affect access to oil. Among those 52 states, fully 50% of their domestic energy demand is supplied and filled by imports of fossil fuels from other countries. So fully 50%, this is across like cars, forms of transport, the electric grid itself, all these different things. Fully half of the country and in effect their economy is at the whims of global markets that they simply cannot control. And this includes giant economics, you know, powerhouses like Germany and Japan. So the solution, in Ember's view, is that these states should invest in what Ember calls electrotech. And the think tank claims that fossil fuel importers could drastically improve their energy security and cut global fossil fuel imports by fully 70% if they invest heavily in three things. One, renewable energy sources like solar and wind, in particular. Two, heat pumps that they can put in residential buildings that are more efficient and run on electricity rather than other forms of fuels, including fossil fuels. And three, move to electric cars rather than internal combustion engines. The big advantage of the shift to renewables and the shift towards heat pumps is that, according to Ember, they require imports roughly once every 30 years. When you need to replace these things, and that's assuming that you can't manufacture them at home. Now, that means that rather than being exposed to global markets, to inflation, to changes in the availability of oil and natural gas and other fossil fuels, these states would have sustainable and durable energy to carry themselves into the future. We might add that Cars are also an important area here, as the United States obviously has a very strong memory of this from the 1970s, when an Arab oil embargo led to very long lines at American gas stations and a genuine crisis of gas. And the United States has, of course, responded as a country that has a lot of oil would predictably do, which is to make a lot more oil and have a big strategic reserve. But these other states don't have that opportunity. Now, electric vehicles are very helpful because fundamentally their source of energy is fungible. They can either get electricity from fossil fuels or nuclear energy or renewable energy or whatever a state wants to provide. And so they are able to have far more flexibility in their transport industry than they otherwise would. So we'll finish here with a quote from Kingsmill Bond, one of the authors of the Ember Report. Quote, fossil importing nations are like frogs in boiling water, failing to detect the gradually increasing danger, Bond argued. Electrotech offers the fastest escape route from this escalating threat. So that is the last of our stories for this intro section today. Thank you for sticking around with us through these. I'm very excited now to move to my conversation with Michael Brendan Doherty of the National Review. Just as a reminder, Michael, of course, is a prominent conservative writer and a prominent Catholic analyst of the world. And we're going to be talking about all things to do with Pope Francis and international affairs. It's a very, very interesting topic, and definitely would love to have everyone stick around for that. So I will see you in that interview. Hey, Michael, how you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Why don't I go ahead and introduce us again? So as people know by now, I'm Connor Eccles, the managing editor of Nonzero and the host of this show, Nonzero World. And you are Michael Brendan Doherty, a very prominent conservative columnist. You're a senior writer at National Review and a William F. Buckley senior scholar at the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. Is it the, are there multiple William F. Buckley scholars?
I'm the only one.
You are the only one. So awesome. That is good. So I think that thoroughly establishes your conservative bona fides right there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But anyway, so I'm very interested to have you on the podcast today, because obviously this past week, the Pope Francis passed away, and you have written a great deal about his pontificate, about particularly his approach to the church, but I'm going to try to dig more into his approach to foreign policy today. And it's kind of an interesting topic, of course, just to give listeners a sense, because when you think of religions, you don't necessarily think of foreign policy. But of course, the Vatican has formal relations with almost all of the world's states, has diplomats, has ambassadors known as nuncios, and engages in actual kind of foreign policy in that way. So I think this will be a great discussion to dig into that. But first, as a sort of framing question, you know, you've often been critical of the way that Pope Francis had approached, I guess, managing the church itself in terms of its internal affairs. But I'm kind of curious how you think about how he handled international affairs during his time as Pope.
Well, I think a mixed record, but it's not one he shouldn't be proud of. I mean, the Pope should be a voice for peace. It would be, there is something a bit ill-fitting when we look back in history and see popes leading wars themselves. And there's something odd too about it, there's something that we've always felt uncomfortable, like a mixed legacy about the Crusades themselves, right? Because they were diverted so far from their original purpose and into such needless violence, in many cases, sacking other Christians and you know, moved very far away from the idea of the original pilgrimage that they were intended to be. So we have this legacy, you know, the papacy has been a restraining force on violence, a moral critic of violence going back into you know, the first centuries of the church and into the Middle Ages, you know, the popes have written papal bulls against modern weapons at each stage, whether that was the crossbow or nuclear weapons.
Is that right? The crossbow, even? I hadn't heard
of
that.
Yeah, the crossbow was not to be... The popes tried to ban Christians from using the crossbow. There was a kind of feeling that it was an unvirtuous weapon precisely because it was like a medieval bomb, right? Mm. That it didn't... You weren't showing the skill of a marksman. You were firing basically into a crowd and right. hoping it killed. So yeah, there's this moral tradition of criticizing war. We have a just war, very highly developed just war doctrine that we have from St. Augustine. And the Pope Francis regularly called for peace. And he did so in the most, highly moralized language, right? I mean, he said that the war on Russia, Russia's war in Ukraine was shameful for all of humanity. No, so not even just shameful for Russia, but shameful for all of humanity. And he talked about the martyrdom of Ukraine, which, you know, is highly evocative language. At the same time, he also, you know, he is not one of these people who, thinks that the West should back Ukraine all the way to the hilt and try to topple the regime in Moscow. You know, and he's said things like, again, in very radical language, that Ukraine should have the courage of the white flag and negotiate an end to war with Russia. So that's him on the most recent conflict. And then broader, he's been a huge critic of militarism itself, even apart from war. He criticizes the arms industry as an immoral industry and military buildup, even in the absence of war, as a kind of death wish. So he's been very active, and the church remains active. I mean, I would say even too, not just Pope Francis, but there are cardinals gathering in Rome now for the conclave, like Cardinal Rangith, who have inserted themselves. He's the Archbishop of Colombo, and he inserted himself into the civil war in Sri Lanka in a pretty dramatic way between the Sri Lankan government and the Tamil Tigers. And he also shares in this legacy of human rights concerns and peacemaking. So I think fits very well with what Francis was aiming at.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm curious too. I mean, a very interesting development kind of over the past, I guess, 100 years that Pope Francis embodied in many ways was the geographical like diversification of the church, right? Yeah. So the Catholic Church used to be so centered in Europe, and now its center of gravity has moved towards Latin America. There's a substantial portion. I mean, it's nearly as many, there are nearly as many Catholics now in sub-Saharan Africa as in Europe, and in relative terms, it's kind of stark. And so you see the sort of transfer, the spread of Catholicism. And it's interesting because Pope Francis also kind of carried that spirit forward with his efforts to sort of reconcile with other religions and also reconcile with states that are considered sort of adversaries with the West, right? So he wasn't like Pope St. John Paul II. He was not as much of a loud critic of like communism or things like that. Pope Francis was more focused on sort of seeking opportunities for dialogue with Russia, with China, with different states, in ways that did get him a certain amount of criticism. So I'm curious how you would judge those efforts.
Well, you know, it's interesting, you know, so the church has its own moral tradition of reflecting on the justice of war. It has its tradition of criticizing certain kinds of weaponry, certain tactics of warfare. And at the same time, you know, people say they criticized the crossbow, but they licensed siege warfare in the Middle Ages many times. You know, the church is also in the world, and it's churchmen are formed as citizens of their own countries and their own civilizations. And you see that, right? You see in John Paul II, you know, you had this profound Polish anti-communism in his writing and in his work. And you're seeing now with the shift to the global South, you're seeing, you know, people of various stripes, like Pope Francis is considered, you know, maybe a bit of a liberal and a progressive in church matters. You know, he had a certain kind of Argentine anti-American streak in his thinking, and a critical eye of colonialism and imperialism. But you see that as well in, you know, so-called conservative and traditionalist churchmen from the former Third World. So one potential candidate, the traditionalist Cardinal Robert Sarah from Guinea, who was nearly killed by that country's dictator. He is also a critic of colonialism. You know, sees that as a force that's been kind of under critiqued by the church in Rome. At the same time, he's also like almost like a populist anti-immigrationist when it comes to Europe. So, you know, the church, you know, it has this otherworldly aspect to it, but it also is in the world, and it's not a surprise to see Francis or others adopting some of the moral critiques around them as their own. My own personal assessment, I think the Vatican did bend over too far in its dealing with the Chinese state. I think it ended up in an unsatisfactory position, where it was in some ways selling out both the underground church and the official church.
Yeah. Do you want to give a little bit of maybe the kind of background for that, just to help listeners?
It's very difficult. So, Chinese Catholicism, you know, the church has been trying to crack China for five centuries. And it's been difficult mission territory. After the communist takeover of mainland China, there was a kind of breaking with the Roman Church, a kind of break off of communications. So you saw things like the official church continue liturgy in Latin in China, where everywhere else it went into the vernacular after the Vatican Council in the 60s. And you saw these just unique practices. You saw sometimes veneration of pictures of Mao and others kind of interspersed with veneration of icons and other traditional practices. At the same time, you also saw this resistance church in, you know, grow up in the underground. And it was tended to by courageous priests and people like Cardinal Zen, who's been located in Hong Kong and associated with a lot of like Hong Kong, you know, pro-democracy, pro-free speech politics in China. And Cardinal Zen, who is not a voting age anymore, but is in Rome, I think, to give his own view to other cardinals about the Vatican's deal, which it made a few years ago. The Secretary of State and Pope Francis wanted a deal where they could appoint bishops. I mean, this has actually been a struggle for the church throughout history, is does it have the freedom to pick its own bishops? I mean, when the American Revolution happened, the Vatican wrote to George Washington and basically asked, like, who among us would you find suitable as candidates for bishops? And he said, none of my business, right? Like, but in Europe traditionally, and in China now, this is seen as potentially threatening to statecraft.
Right.
So the Vatican came up with an arrangement where the Chinese government could propose certain candidates and the Vatican could select among them. Or, you know, there were some instances in which the Chinese state could veto candidates suggested by the Vatican for the episcopacy. So it's and at the same time, there probably is an underground cardinal somewhere in China that was appointed under Benedict. So it's a very delicate situation. At once the church wants to relieve the persecution of its own members, but at the same time, it's seeking a modicum of freedom and independence from the state that the state is not very inclined to give it. And I think, you know, the Vatican said some embarrassing things about how, like, the Chinese government embodies Catholic social teaching, when they were in this flattery campaign. And, I take seriously, though, that the Vatican is not in a strong position. And in some ways, it feels Stalin's own critique of, you know, how many divisions has the Pope, that it doesn't really have the juice to tell Xi Jinping to sit down. And that, in fact, China's, you know, highly surveilled society is difficult to operate in, you know, is much more difficult to operate in clandestinely than was Elizabethan England, you know, centuries ago.
Yeah, it's a very interesting. It's really the area that I think he was criticized most harshly for, especially from the more conservative side. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, there is just this interesting balance between, you know, a desire for the church to be neutral in all ways, and this thing where, you know, it really embodies the spirit of the Vatican sort of diplomatic corps too, where they're so focused on mediation. It's all these sort of diplomat priests that are highly trained in kind of seeing the perspective of others and working towards reconciliation. But then, you know, in this case, it's just a challenge because it's how you deal with the authorities. But one interesting thing I found, you know, this week while I was reading up on some aspects of this, I hadn't realized that John Paul II, in his nomination to be a bishop initially of Krakow, this is just kind of an interesting fact. The communist government had stopped the first like five or six nominations for that position that the Vatican wanted, and they viewed him as sort of the least offensive. Or the least likely to cause trouble. And there's a great irony there because, of course, he became the Pope that would lead, you know, eventually to the Solidarity Movement. And it's just there's a tough balance for the church in these things.
Yeah, there's always been. And like I said, the church, you know, in a way, has only recently escaped the influence of the state on its choice of bishops in Europe. I mean, you had a kind of Habsburg veto that was extant into the 20th century. I mean, this has been a long journey for the church, you know, basically dating back to the, it goes back to this, you know, there's all these church state moments of clash going back to the snows of Canossa. But really the state sort of surpassed the church in its power and authority in the Middle Ages, in the late Middle Ages and in the modern period. And the church has had to deal with various kings, queens, imperial interests before. It's part of its history. And it finds a way to muddle through usually. But again, the China one is particularly difficult, because now you even have like traditionalist, missionaries sneaking into China. And then they're doing the Latin mass, and people in the underground church think they're government spies because they're doing Latin, which is emblematic of the official church, you know, so there's there's so many ironies and just oddities to deal with when it comes to China. And there are other orders like the Jesuits who've done heroic work, trying to mediate between the underground church and the official church in China, the recognized church. And, that work is very treacherous, for them, because passions run very, very hot, and understandably so. So it's China is an interesting dilemma. I think it's something that may be revisited in a future pontificate. Just because I think many people feel that the deal is kind of already dead, that in many ways the Chinese government has already transgressed it. And so that, you know, they may seek something else if there's a new head of the Communist Party in China, after Xi Jinping, after the reign of Xi Jinping.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too. And of course, a major aspect of sort of Vatican diplomacy that's unique is that there's a great deal of discretion, and we actually don't even know the contents of the deal itself.
No, that's the other thing. Most of the stuff is subjected to rumor and strange critique. I mean, you expect maybe someone like Cardinal Zen has some sources in the mainland and in elsewhere to get some of the criticisms he has of the deal, but it's very difficult. And then on the other side, the diplomatic corps in the Vatican has been hugely active under Francis. I mean, they have made offerings to Moscow and to Kiev about holding peace talks, as other governments have, like the Israeli government, and now the Saudis and Hungarians are doing their bit. But the Vatican wants to be a player, and doesn't shy away from this public role, and nor should it, given its history.
Right. Yeah. A big example of that kind of working out quite clearly, it was reversed only a few years later under President Trump. But do you want to talk a little bit about the role that Pope Francis and the Vatican played in the somewhat normalization of relations between the U.S. and Cuba?
Oh, I'm not a total expert on this, but it is, going back to John Paul II, there's been there was a huge desire in Rome and in the Vatican to, some way reach out to the Cuban people. And you saw John Paul II visit. Sometimes he was criticized because, in the background there are pictures of Che Guevara or some other communist figure that, John Paul II is supposed to abominate. But he went to Cuba and ministered there. And I think that started this work. And it was just time when, it was waiting for a U.S. administration that had any kind of, willingness to revisit this question, right? I mean, in many ways, this is, this policy is meant to, the question of American Cuba policy is this policy meant to just censure Cuba for having a communist government and isolate it until it no longer has one? Or was this policy meant to affect change and it's just, and we need to declare it a failure, after so many decades? Mm. And with Cuba's no longer having a sponsor government, I mean, Beijing does not sponsor Cuba in the way that Moscow did. And Cuba's had to kind of grope about the region for sympathetic leftist governments in Latin America, for various economic lifelines and deals. It's just, I think the Vatican correctly assessed that this was a new world for Cuba, and they did some of the first preparatory work in normalizing it. At the same time now, I'll point out, I don't know when Obama exactly jumped on the bandwagon. I would say at the same time now, the Vatican is now facing a huge challenge in Nicaragua. The Sandinista regime, long ago exceeded its constitutional authority after, it rewrote the constitution when it came into power, and it was Daniel Ortega's long since exceeded his term limits. And while there were many churchmen allies of the Sandinistas in the 1980s, many of them coming from Europe, That's no longer the case. And the Nicaraguan government is now persecuting the church in a way that's pretty much unprecedented in the Western world. Expelling bishops, expelling priests, you know, native Nicaraguan priests to Rome. Recently, they've been requiring all priests to submit all their homilies to police before they're given. There's endemic spying and just a really difficult situation for the church, which has become a scapegoat for the government. And, you know, Pope Francis has expressed his solidarity with the Nicaraguan people, and at the same time is trying not to provoke further anger, has tried not to provoke further anger and retribution by the government. And again, that's always been a, that's been a perennial problem for the church as well, right? That you don't, they don't have, you know, they don't have a physical force. You know, there are no Vatican ninjas. The Swiss Guard is not, you know, going to be deployed by amphibious assault into any country to save Catholics in them. So yeah, the Vatican has always had this difficulty of how do we criticize governments without further endangering our people, right? I mean, there were times this has been heavily debated ever since the Second World War and the church's relationship with the German state under Nazism. You know, that there were heroic archbishops that criticized the Nazi government, and Hitler almost beheaded some of them, or wanted to behead some of these bishops. But at the same time, the church, you know, many churchmen lent their support once Hitler turned on Stalin.
Right.
So anyway, that's a wide ranging review from Cuba going back to the 1930s.
No, that's very helpful. And one thing I would add on the Cuba thing is just you know, it was an interesting moment early in Pope Francis's time as the pontiff, because, you know, this was only a year or two after his election, maybe, that he kind of ended up almost leading this effort, because my understanding was that you had the bishops of Boston and Havana, both of whom were fairly close personally with Pope Francis, and they asked him to help with mediation. And the final agreement was even reached in the Vatican itself. You know, the final agreement between both sides that produced at least some measure of normalization. So it's a funny thing, the kind of direct sort of impacts that you can see from Vatican diplomacy, particularly when there are sort of Catholics on either side of a dispute.
Yeah, this is, and that's the church's advantage, right? Is being universal and being present almost across the entire globe outside of, you know, outside of the Muslim world, in which it's pretty contained or sometimes absent. Although we could talk about some of that too, if we talk about Jerusalem.
Maybe we could turn to I guess I'm curious. Well, did you have something to add there before we?
No. But I'm just saying that the diplomacy often turns on these personal relationships, and the church is lucky enough to be this universal institution that occasionally, you know, you will get people from Cuba and Boston bumping up to each other in Rome or at some other conference. And you know, the states would be well advised to turn to bishops to build on personal relationships between, you know, each other and then with a leader to leader on the political side.
Absolutely. Well, why don't we go ahead, and go to the Middle East then, because sure. I guess I'm curious, this seems like an area where, I won't put words in your mouth, but I suspect you might be more critical of Pope Francis's approach to the war in Gaza. He's certainly kind of associated himself more with the pro-ceasefire position from the very beginning, within days of the Hamas attacks in Israel. He was calling for a ceasefire. He was talking about ending the bloodshed. He very famously held daily calls with the only Catholic parish in Gaza, and you know, has really been one of the most prominent advocates at the international level in favor of ending the war. And I'm curious to get your take on that from your perspective, because I don't understand you to be against the war in its entirety.
No, I'm not against the war. I do think Israel has a just cause against Hamas and has pursued that at tremendous human cost. And, but I do not agree with people who call what Israel is doing a genocide. I just don't think, the strategy and tactics Israel's deployed in Gaza amount to that. I don't think the death toll, given that it's urban warfare, rises to that level, and especially given the composition of victims, which the majority are men between 14 and 55. I just don't...
It's a quite wide range, I must say.
It is a quite wide range, but that there are 17-year-old fighters in Hamas is not in dispute. But anyway, I don't believe it's a genocide, and I believe they have a just war. However, I totally agree with the Pope that the war itself is awful, that people should be seeking a peaceful resolution, one that is livable for everyone who lives in these territories. So, you know, it's not that I'm disgusted with anything the Pope has done. And again, just reaching out to this one particular parish is, you know, a grand and very sweet and paternal gesture, which seems totally fitting for the Pope. So yeah, I you know, even if I think Israel has a just cause, I have no problem with the Pope asking for peace. And again, I think that should be the Pope's role as a mediator. You know, not every, you know, again, like the message of the gospel is something that in many ways will relativize even quite stark and you know, seemingly principled political claims. You know, that call for peace, hatred of violence, and the injustice it necessarily inflicts as collateral damage. Even the word collateral damage is kind of sickening when it comes out of the mouth, and what you're talking about is the death of innocent non-combatants. You know, of course he should be calling for peace. You know, and that will have a way of relativizing the claims of Israel and the claims of, you know, anti-Israeli political movements as well.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting position. I mean, I mentioned before the call, the Pope was almost a restrainer, I guess, in foreign policy terms. It's not quite a one-to-one thing. It's more that he was, you know, obviously he's not... not looking from the perspective of the United States, for one. Which kind of, but in many ways, the restraint foreign policy movement kind of agreed with sort of the vast majority of his proclamations on these different things.
Yeah, I would say that's true. I would say that the thing that Pope Francis and the Catholic Church has in common with, you know, restrainer or realism, is that there's no special ideological privilege given to democracy. You know, the church is just too old and too experienced in this world and the way of the world. And itself is not a democracy, right? Itself is a monarchy.
Right.
So it knows that people live, you know, people bleed just as much under dictatorships or autocracies, monarchies or theocracies as they do in democracy. And so it doesn't overweigh democracy in the way it views geopolitics. And I think that's what puts it at odds with so many Americans who sort of do give a privilege to democracy, do think that there's no moral equivalence between the demands of democratic peoples and their governments and autocratic governments on the other hand. So I think it's that kind of indifference, indifference isn't even quite the right word. But like I said, it's more of a realistic acknowledgement of that there are different forms of government under which everyone has to still get on living.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And I'm curious, obviously with the case of a papal conclave, as we'll have coming up, there's no realistic way to really know what the cardinals are thinking. There's no way to know who the next man to don the white zucchetto will be. But I am kind of curious, if you think that there will be certain ways in which a new pope might want to change the approach to foreign policy, if there's any things like that. And if there's anything that, you've been relatively positive, I think, throughout this conversation about Pope Francis' approach, but if there are things that you wish that he had handled differently, maybe in the China issue or other things, I'm kind of curious.
Well, I would say, I'm not without criticism of Francis. I actually think he's wrong.
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.